Hello, it's Mark McClellan from the Brookings Institution, Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform, and I'd like to thank all of you for joining us, the Engelberg Center team, for our continuing series of roundtable discussions on medical product surveillance. As you know, these sessions are meant to be interactive, and we're looking forward to some discussions of today, as in previous day, of projects that are relevant to this shared interest in developing a national infrastructure for medical product safety surveillance. With this interactive discussion, we're going to have both a presentation and plenty of time for questions and comments from all of you later in the call. Today, we're going to do an online web presentation, and at this point, all of your lines should be automatically muted, but you might want to confirm that checking on your phone. To mute your phone, all you need to do is press *6 to unmute it, and you can press *7. Also, there's a Q&A tab at the top of your screen if you're logged into the web presentation, which you can use to submit questions at any time during the presentation. We'd encourage you to go ahead and do that. When you have the questions, they're going to go into a queue, and then we'll try to get to them in as organized and efficient way as possible when we're done. So that's why it helps us to see them sooner rather than later. Now, if there are any technical problems with any of this, please give a call to the Brookings IT Help Desk at 202-797-6193. So with that as technical background, I'd like to turn to the substance and introduce today's roundtable topic and our presenters. During our second annual Sentinel Initiative public workshop back in January, we talked about how in most situations, drug safety analyses conducted through Sentinel would not require the exchange of protected health information, but in some situations it may be necessary to share limited protected health information. And that means it's crucial to develop methods and technologies to protect privacy and ensure the security of the data. Today, we're going to hear about the South Carolina Health Information Exchange, or SCIEX, South Carolina Health Information Exchange. It's a statewide health information exchange that brings together claims and clinical data in a federated fashion that follows emerging IT standards. This is a real-world operational example of a distributed data network built primarily to improve patient care and built on a core of some claims and other administrative data. But it's also able to answer some important questions about quality of care at the population level. To do this, SCIEX also employs a technically sophisticated process of ensuring patient privacy and data security. So presenting today, we're going to hear from three people who work closely with the SCIEX program. The first presenter is Sue Greer, the president and CEO of Carolina Health Centers. Sue is going to provide an overview of SCIEX and its activities in South Carolina. Following Sue, David Greer, section chief of the Health and Demographic Products for the South Carolina Budget and Control Board, will discuss technical solutions from a statewide perspective, and from a state, from a state perspective in particular. And then lastly, Vic Ketterpal, the president and CEO of Care Evolution, which is a technology partner to SCIEX, will talk about lessons from the project that may apply to Sentinel as well, where there's similar kinds of issues of protecting individual sensitive information, but at the same time learning from clinical information that's really only possible by linking data and having relatively clinically sophisticated observations for analysis. So again, as usual, after these presentations, we'll have plenty of time for Q&A, and really encourage you all to ask any questions you may have. And I want to remind you that you can submit questions at any time during these presentations in the Q&A tab at the top of your screen. And actually, that because of the feedback, I can make some of these corrections on the fly. I'm sorry for misstating the names of our presenters. Sue Veer, V-E-E-R, and David Patterson, not a couple of Greers. Sorry about the name mix up there. Sue, now that I've properly introduced you, can I turn the next phase of this presentation over to you?
Certainly, good afternoon. And I want to thank you for inviting us to this discussion. And actually, Dave and I are good friends. Now we're brother and sister, so that's okay. We do appreciate being invited into this discussion, very important topic. It looks, the first slide that you're looking at outlines four issues that were identified at the second annual Sentinel FDA meeting. And it sounds like from these issues that you're dealing with some of the same issues that we've been dealing with here in South Carolina around how to exchange data in a private and secure environment, how to protect that patient privacy while really achieving the necessary outcomes that we're looking for. Art, basically with SCIEX, although, as you can see from these objectives, first and foremost, our intent with SCIEX has been to give providers a tool to enhance clinical decision-making and promote efficiency and patient safety, it has proven to be an extremely useful tool for care coordination, for case management, patient education in some areas, and then using aggregate de-identified data, we've seen marked improvement in the targeted clinical outcome measures in certain areas. One of the things that this has allowed us to do is have the information about our patients move at the same pace as our patients so that it's available at the time of care when it's needed. Originally, long before there was any funding, the HITECH Act, SCIEX was conceived as a public good, if you will. It was perceived as an infrastructure that would be designed to provide an affordable core technology for the collective good of the public, a public utility, if you will. The technology was designed, as we've talked about, around privacy, which we're going to discuss in much greater detail throughout this presentation. Notably, one of the most notable things about SCIEX is that we were able to leverage a unique state asset in the South Carolina Budget and Control Board's Office of Research and Statistics, which for over 10 years has been collecting data based on statutory requirement for UB data statewide and a budget proviso that allows them to collect data from a variety of agencies, mental health, social service, the Medicaid claims data. Having that available has been extremely beneficial in, number one, keeping costs down, and number two, creating immediate value for the users of the data.
Okay. We just had a minor technical problem.
This just shows you that we basically did want to design the system around privacy. Notably, we wanted to have the ability to link information in a hyper-secure fashion, but leave the data where it lives in the original source record, the federated model that Dr. McClellan referred to. The development of the governance framework for SCIEX has and continues to be interesting and challenging work. Early on, we identified an interesting model in the marketplace, the Connecting for Health framework, which was founded and supported by the Markle Foundation with additional support from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And this framework is like a set of traffic rules. Basically, it enables the pieces of information to travel when and where they're needed in a safe and secure manner. It consists of both technical and policy guidelines around the principles that you see up on the screen, openness and transparency, purpose specification, use limitation, individual participation and control, which has been an overarching theme for us in designing our policies and procedures, data integration, security, oversight, and accountability, and then remedies for inappropriate use of data. As we've worked around governance using this framework, we've really identified four key things that are important to keep in mind. Number one, the choices about one affect the other. In other words, you're dealing with technical principles or technical guidelines and policy guidelines. They essentially affect each other. A decision about one affects the other. To build trust within our organization, in our case across the state, we've opted to put policy decisions first and to a great degree allow the policy to drive the technology development. We've had to allow for interdependent evolution of the policies and procedures, and then the last thing I would say we've learned is that the technology is essentially easy compared to the governance and the policies that protect privacy. What we also have discovered is that intersecting point at the core of this, where all of the various privacy principles intersect, have come together to create for us some core operating principles, the things that have basically driven the development of our operational guidelines. The first is that the health information exchange is merely a new modality for exchanging information that we're already sharing. For many of us, we thought of it as not being a whole lot different than getting a fax machine, although we recognize in the public's eye it's significantly different. The HIE itself does not own or store any medical data. Ownership rests with the source record where that data lives. Consequently, data requests from patients or any other individual have to be driven directly back to the source record. The HIE governing body creates the minimum standard, but we have worked over the course of a number of months to develop policies where we are continually pushing accountability and responsibility for compliance out to the provider and the user organizations. Basically, another operating principle is that we have to recognize that the principle of individual participation and control creates opportunities for some holes in information. Essentially, the HIE is not a patient's complete record, and both on the patient side and the provider side, there has to be clear understanding of that. Use of the HIE doesn't alter the provider's responsibility for thorough evaluation and appropriate clinical decision making. And the HIE, while it is predominantly used to enable clinical decision making at the individual patient level, it is extremely valuable at the population level for driving decisions about best practice. Having said that, let me tell you a little bit. This shows you how we view it. This is a schematic showing how we view it as a core technology. SkyX essentially resides in the middle of this slide, providing all of the technology services. On the, as you face the screen left hand of the slide, you see faucets, essentially one-way directional feeds of information. On the right-hand side, you have bidirectional feeds of information, where not only is the entity, the regional network, if you will, receiving claims data, but they're also feeding live clinical data back into the system as well. One of those entities is Lakeland's Rural Health Network, which I am currently the board chair for. Very briefly, Lakeland's is a six-county partnership of key players at all levels, various settings of care in the Lakeland's area. And our goal is to foster collaboration and strengthen the healthcare delivery system. We believe that the network was conceived in order to basically strengthen the network as a whole, or the delivery system as a whole. As a result of our work with our providers, we very quickly identified health information technology to be the highest priority for strengthening our healthcare delivery system, and became the first operational model for SkyX. We've been clinically operational now for going on a year, I would think, with three organizations, all on disparate electronic health records, exchanging clinical information. And as they say, a picture's worth a thousand words, so what I have up on the screen right now is just a very basic screenshot that shows you, if a provider logs on, what they are likely to see. I'm not going to go into a great amount of detail explaining this because this is really at the individual patient care level, but each of these elements it represents an incident of care or an event of care, which if you hover over it will give you significantly more detail. Because of that unique asset, that 10 years of claims data, one of the things that makes SkyX very valuable for our providers is that they've got 10 years worth of history as soon as they log on. So we've not had to wait for that history to build over time. We immediately have some patient history when we log on. That gives you a very brief overview of what SkyX is doing for us at the patient care level. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to David Patterson to talk about really how this all works.
What I'd like to do is talk a bit about SkyX's federated architecture and then iterate back again on some themes that that Sue has already mentioned, themes of privacy protection while still allowing for the possibility of aggregation and data integration, and also to give you sort of South Carolina's twist on the notion of federation, because the project really began with the ORS's data warehouse that Sue has already mentioned. As has already been said, we are by law the recipient of all uniform billing data in the state and actually have a separate data oversight council that governs our activities surrounding that, and that speaks to the theme of interlocking governance protections as well as the technology. And as was also previously mentioned, we're the recipient of all of the Medicaid claims data in the state down to the specific line item. And Medicaid in South Carolina covers roughly 25% of the population, nearly half of the children, and, of course, contains both ambulatory and inpatient claims information as well as information on drugs. And so our take on essentially the federated model was to actually begin with a warehouse and deploy it. And that's part of what makes us hybrid, is that rather than pulling data back into a CDR, a centralized repository, we're taking an existing repository and moving it back. So some of our goals and concerns are very similar to what we see with the FDA's Sentinel initiative. I think what our motivations for doing it may have been perhaps a little different, but I think some of the touchstones that you have in the process are virtually identical. When we began, as Sue so eloquently put it, we began at looking at trying to provide value for providers right out of the box. When we first encountered this as an organization, it was in an EHI conference back in 2006, and the problem or the concern there was connecting enough providers to give them something that was meaningful and useful to them initially. And so we thought of using the claims data to do that and partnered with Care Evolution to develop the core record location and terminology services solutions that enable that while leveraging the data holdings that we had here at ORS. And so very quickly we were able to build a 10-year history, as already been described, covering 6.1 million consumers, all Medicaid initially, as well as the uniform billing, all payer data housed at ORS to build up the Master Patient Index and RLS solution, which is pretty extensive. Our goal was to, again, jumpstart an HIE with that by demonstrating value before there was ERA funding to incentivize providers to do those sorts of things. Use the claims data to create a longitudinal health record that has great, great breadth to which we could eventually attract clinical depth. So the idea is to build it, see if we can provide something that's feasible for providers to join, let them add the clinical depth and make use of it. And as we did it, we were always very practically focused and very incremental in our approach, always moving governance step by step with the technology, but also paying close attention to the providers. And so that's why you see the rather interesting quote there from Professor Yogi Berra, because in theory, doing many of these things, theory and practice should be the same, but in practice, they're actually different. What you're seeing here is a basic timeline, so you understand sort of the line of march that has taken place in South Carolina, and it gives you some illustration, again, of the needs to erect appropriate governance at each stage as you move this forward incrementally, and also the ability to add on value and additional feature sets and user bases as you move forward. If you look at the very beginning, as has been said a couple of times, this began with the ORS warehouse and also the various statutes surrounding our operations, Most notably there is the Medicaid Data Review Committee and also the Data Oversight Council for the UB data that provided authorization for us to partner with Care Evolution in building the Master Patient Index Record Location solution. Followed shortly behind, once that was created and tested, and you'll hear a little bit about some of the testing that we did, both at ORS and at Lakeland's. Once we were confident that we had a production-capable RLS federated solution, we immediately looked to our partners at Lakeland's Rural Health Network, which we already had various relationships with and discussions with, about the possibility of doing a live pilot. And as Sue has told you, back in 2007, they immediately began using the state infrastructure, including the state federated model and RLS solution, to drive their own regional exchange within a six-county area, with additional testing and clinical uses and numerous lessons learned from that process, both technically and in terms of governance. Followed shortly behind that with additional funding from Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation of South Carolina, SCIEX was scaled out to the statewide level geographically through a project that looked specifically at coordination of care and quality improvement among ambulatory entities that serve the uninsured, most notably the free medical clinics in South Carolina, as well as the federally qualified health clinics and rural health clinics. The idea of looking at sharing patient population, using the data, again, with de-identified aggregation through this security-respecting solution to provide information on best practices, improvement in quality, and even coordination in terms of sharing a common patient population. As a result of that, also some additional feature sets were added on to SCIEX. Nearly simultaneously, the Medicaid agency chose SCIEX as its platform to make all claims data, all Medicaid claims data, available to any Medicaid enrolled provider in the state of South Carolina free of charge. And we're continuing to do that to this day as the state HIE effort scales out and we move more and more in the direction of bidirectional exchange with all of the providers. But Medicaid has been, from the very beginning, a close partner in this project. And then, of course, in 2009, the ERA High Tech Act is passed, and exchange becomes something that's funded, not an idea that I think interested parties worked on for various reasons, but something that had really a good deal of federal authority and dollars behind it, both in terms of the requirement that a formal governance be created, a state-designated entity be selected, that state HIT coordinators be appointed, and so on, and that strategic and operational plans be reviewed and approved by the ONC in order to acquire funding to scale out, develop or scale out in our case, health information exchange in the states, but also at the same time tied very, very closely to meaningful use incentives provided by CMS through the Medicare program and then via the local Medicaid agencies to incentivize providers to get onto the exchange. And so now, in addition to the notion of putting value out via the claims data, there are also incentives, of course, for the providers to come onto the exchange. And I'm proud to say that South Carolina's SCIEX is actually the ONC-selected solution for that. Fundamental to doing something like SCIEX in a federated model is really the record location solution. And when I talk to providers that are not familiar with these sorts of questions, I use the metaphor of a giant electronic Rolodex, because what you have to do is to be able to identify the patient reliably in a way that protects their privacy and security, and then attach that patient to various sources of records that exist around a federated network, as well as the repository that we hold, and then provide those records back at the point of care. And, of course, in our case also, we have the potential to provide the identified data sets for quality monitoring and so on, which would be of interest to an initiative like Sentinel. As we've done this, as Sue has mentioned, we follow Connecting for Health principles, the previous HITSBI and CCHIP principles, NHIN principles, and, of course, IHE. Again, and now, of course, the ONC's interim final rule. Again, all being standards-based, and that's very, very important for a federated exchange. The idea is basically the data lives where it lives, and a message is sent to the record locator service that can track all of those locations and certify that the locations are on the exchange appropriately, maintain security architecture, and then message back out to the original data sources so that they can all be compiled on the fly at whatever location needs to see them. What we've done with SkyX, again, following sort of the HIE model, which, again, I want to reiterate, the HIE model in terms of principles is very close to the Sentinel model, is essentially federate data from a variety of entities at the sub-state level, be they an integrated regional health information organization like, for example, Lakeland's, that may be using our own master patient index solution and record linking solution, other regional health organizations that may have an MPI solution of their own, as well as integrated delivery systems and individual hospital facilities, clinics, and even individual practices. All of these are integrated through standards-based exchange and leverage the core record linking solution that SkyX provides in order to move data across them. In addition, we also link to a number of extramural sources. You'll see those listed to the right of the slides. Those include, in our upcoming HIE collaborative project, the state's immunization registry, which we'll be engaging in bilateral exchange with, and that's already underway. We anticipate that that will lead to reportable disease data transmissions to the health department over time. We're already working with external reference labs to move their data as well. And then, of course, tying into SureScripts and RxHub for pharmacy data that extends beyond the data holdings that we already have. And again, those data holdings are represented at least partially in the very center of that core, where you see data that's already by state law residing at ORS. Those data are deployed along with any of the calls for data along the federated network. Then beyond that, of course, the future vision is connection via the NHN compliant gateway to various federal facilities. That includes the Centers for Disease Control, the Veterans Administration, and Defense Department medical facilities, which in South Carolina are very, very important given our large active duty and retired populations here in the state, CMS for quality reporting, and also to the Social Security Administration, again, to assist with disability determination. And in the long-run future is to take this same secure federated architecture and record linking and to begin dialogue with other states across state boundaries and jurisdictions, sharing data with our neighbors. And I think that's the long-run vision. But the important point to reiterate here is that all of this cannot happen without transparency, without protection of privacy, without preserving data integrity, and without an absolutely first-class record linking solution. My screen appears to be frozen. So, again, the privacy and security issue and the centerpiece of all of this is the Record Locator Service and Master Patient Index, and it's really the critical weak link for privacy. Anytime you aggregate data into a repository, of course, you increase risk, and that's one of the reasons why ORS, which exists as a repository, simply did not choose to take on the liability and responsibility for pulling all of the data back, moving in the other direction instead. Access to that increases your vulnerability. It increases the likelihood of discovery or discoverability for purposes beyond the intended use of the network, exposes greater threat from within, and also it really decreases trust. It is one thing to ask to connect a number of providers to share data for limited purposes. It is another issue entirely to ask them for the data themselves. So the approach that was taken with SkyX is really blindfolded record linking. Just as you don't, the bank doesn't know the contents of a safe deposit box, the crypto RLS solution can actually link data without knowing the specific identity of the individual in the clear. Instead, it uses essentially hashed likenesses of the data themselves that give an accurate representation in statistical terms of the content of the information without exposing the individual's identity in any way at all. So it takes a lot of the risk out of record linking, does not require any centralization, allows you to do this on the fly, and protects from the various threats that I described earlier. How do we know it works? Well, ORS, as a warehouse and data integrator, has been linking data using its own algorithm since about 2000. And one of the very first things that we did when we engaged in partnership with Care Evolution was begin to evaluate their clinically more appropriate and blinded record linking solution. From our own process, we pull statistical samples every time data is passed through. So we have very well-known properties in terms of our own linking algorithm. These were compared to the results with the RLS, and again, we found that the RLS had higher specificity. Beyond what was done at ORS, Lakeland's Rural Health Network, when they went into production, independently did their own straw man test of the record linking solution and RLS as it was deployed at their location, and ORS had nothing to do with that test whatsoever to preserve sort of independence of results. And again, there were no issues found whatsoever, and to date there has not been a single false positive reported in 3 years of operation. Okay. Now, being able to link these data and to provide integrated and aggregated results in a way that still preserves the privacy of the patients has allowed for a number of innovations and improvement projects that are using the existing core. Lakeland's Rural Health Network, of course, ran a HRSA Flex grant to improve diabetes care across their population, which they were remarkably successful with. Connecting communities of care, which I've mentioned, linking all the free clinics in the state together, as well as a large number of community health centers and rural health clinics. Again, as I mentioned, we've deployed Medicaid data for the 4,000 providers eligible to participate, and all they need to do is go through a sign-up process. Leveraging this technology, the state was recently successful in receiving one of the 10 CHIPRA innovation grants that just came out. We've also have a project in Charleston that uses the care coordination capabilities of this federated architecture for patient navigation. They're one of six of these grants nationwide. And then we also are supporting a telepsychiatry initiative that provides consulting services to 65 potentially EDs around the state through a remote presence technology, and SkyX is essentially the records linking and records exchange solution that undergirds that project. So at that point, I think it's now time for a deeper dive into record linking itself, so I would like to turn the call over to Vic Caterpaul.
And Vic, this is Mark McClellan. Just a reminder to press *7 to unmute your line.
There I am.
There you go.
Can you hear me now? Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thanks, David. So at the risk of, I have the dubious distinction of walking through the really wonky stuff of this presentation, which is the algorithmic challenge of actually accomplishing blindfolded record linkage. And, you know, for those who spend their time thinking about how do I take misspelled names and transpose social security numbers and, you know, transpose date of births that are prevalent through disparate data assets, it all starts with picking a good algorithm or set of algorithms. And as we looked around the industry, the best documented algorithms seem to come actually from the U.S. Census Bureau and the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Agency and some of the work they had been doing literally for the past 20 years or so. And so we began this entire exercise with a probabilistic algorithm that SAMHSA has proven over literally tens of millions of consumer records received from multiple agencies, and they have some gold standard data sets so you can actually evaluate the sensitivity and specificity of the linkage. you know, how to make this work privacy protecting or blindfolding was the next big challenge, of course, because in order to link folks, you got to share date of birth, first name, last name, social security number, as much demographic information as possible, and of course, that is PHI at its core. And if the exercise is how do we create linking across disparate data assets without disclosing privacy, in other words, PHI, it requires some sort of an innovative technique to do so, because the best algorithm in the world requires a good substrate of such identifiers in order to perform linking. And that led us to, you know, essentially a set of techniques, essentially hash functions, to obfuscate the actual PHI itself, but rather to create algorithmic transformations of, say, a first name or a last name that are unique likenesses of the name but are irreversible operations, which at its core is what a hash function does. In essence, takes an inbound string and turns it into a fingerprint. You can imagine if you could compare fingerprints from disparate contributors of such fingerprints, you could have pretty decent linking amongst the various sites without actually knowing the identity of who that fingerprint went with. And that is basically the analogy of what a hash function could do with PHI. And so the idea basically is, how can we go ahead and maybe hash the PHI and then share it and perform linking? And sort of the bone in the chicken, it comes in that hash functions are highly sensitive. So my name is East Indian in origin, and I go by V-I-K Vic, but a very, very common misspelling is V-I-C. V-I-K and V-I-C would generate completely different fingerprints, so to speak, and thereby completely functionally obviating the what you're trying to accomplish, which is to link Vic and Vic, so to speak. And so some interesting techniques have to be employed to both perform this obfuscation using hashing and to do what's called approximate linking or matching, where things that are minor misspellings of names, where common transpositions of social security numbers in the last digit that are well-known errors that happen in entry of such identifiers or recipient IDs, that one could accommodate and be forgiving of those kinds of approximate mistakes and yet be able to use hashing. And it's the combination of the two that requires the computationally intensive aspects of this algorithm. And the technique is basically to generate permutations. So if you may imagine, you know, instead of just linking Vic from one site and its hash key to the hash key generated by VIC, which are guaranteed computationally to not match to each other, what if we generated common misspellings of Vic and created a set of identifiers from each site and its common misspellings and sent that forward to the record locator service or the blinded record index? Then we could perform comparisons between the set of identifiers that approximate the name to the other set received from the other side. And that's basically the steps that are followed. Yeah. To summarize, essentially, before a participating federated member like Lakeland's Rural Health Network, which is running six adapters actually at its site, distinct federated hospitals, FQHCs, critical access hospitals, each of them takes the PHI, standardizes it, generates the hashes, and then sends the hashed permutations that are generated at its site over to the record locator service. And then the record locator service performs its comparisons and maintains and persists only the hashed result set. In practice, what this looks like, to make it very concrete, is we might actually use different permutation engines. For first name, there are linguistic techniques like bigramming or n-gramming or edit distance that can be used to generate approximate errors and nicknames can be pre-generated. For example, Pete and Peter, there are nickname libraries available from the U.S. Census Bureau, for example, that can be created so that you actually generate such permutations and then hash them. For date of birth, transpositions are generated prior to hashing. And similarly, for a social security number, you might generate permutations and transpositions prior to creating that. And recording your proximity score to the original string before you send it up to the record locator service. This stuff all makes it to the central site, which now is a repository of these one-way hashed large set of hash keys, sets of hash keys being received from these various federated entities, and these federated entities are commingled, their hash keys are commingled to determine what matches what else using pairwise comparison scores from the old SAMHSA algorithm, and that results in a match, and if so, one is able to actually create a link between two comparisons. This is basically a synopsis of the four steps. And then the next page, we actually look at, you know, at the record locator service, the links are created, and we may find that a record A is, in fact, sufficiently close as a set of permutated hash keys to the set of permutated hash keys received from B to be called a link, a definite link. And these various links combine to create patients, and sets of identifiers may combine to create patients. And this all sounds very complex, but let's remember, you know, this is why we needed a very large data asset, and ORS provided nearly 200 distinct contributors of PHI in its data repository that we were able to treat as 200 participants that are statewide, actually close to 240, to jumpstart this effort in South Carolina. And the end result is that by going through this process, one can actually increase the specificity of the algorithm because one may be able to find hints from, you know, here's an example of, you know, married name versus maiden name of an individual, one of them lacking social security number, the other one having it. And as you can see in the middle there, you know, the record for my wife received from source A1 matches A2 because of the availability of social security number, even though the last name, which is a known transposition for female gender, because of date of birth may be matching, and the algorithm will pick that up. But A1 and A3 would not have picked up because there's not enough confidence for the missing SSN. And yet, because we have more than three participants in the network, we can, with confidence, promote the A1 to A3 link. And the point is, by using these federated entities, you can actually increase specificity without, increase sensitivity without sacrificing the specificity. Well, that's a lot of detail related to how to obfuscate PHI and yet do approximate matching. And, you know, going back to, I think Jeff Brown went through a review from a data architecture perspective back on January 11th as to when might we want for something like active medical product surveillance the ability to link. And obviously, there are environments where you may want to do it because of longitudinal need of tracking a consumer over time, where the data assets may in fact be overlapping and there may be double counting of the subjects, or data assets, one of them happens to be an ambulatory EHR repository and another happens to be largely an inpatient repository. How could you find signals that start at one and maybe continue through the other phase of care? Another way of thinking about this is, you know, looking at a Venn diagram where we may have good inpatient claim data sets from a claims aggregator in the marketplace, and we could have wonderful PBM data from a pharmacy aggregator, but if both of them were blinded and unlinked, it may be difficult to actually add the drug prescription history to the inpatient claims. which may be the place where the eventual health outcome of interest may be found. And so the idea would be to have essentially a retrofit of existing models of something like the Sentinel Initiative, where one can imagine in this diagram that the participants that are the federated partners maintaining their data begin to subscribe to this blindfolded record-linking web service hosted at a trusted entity, a central authority, that returns back essentially what are called GUIDs in the industry, that it links that particular distributed partner's patient record to other partners' patient records without actually disclosing to either partner who the other collaborators' actual identifiers are. And the Centralized Research Corps, and we're just thinking out loud here, at Mini Sentinel could continue to maintain its current services, but also subscribe to the record locator service, or we call it the BRI, the Blinded Record Index, so that it can actually receive a longitudinally relevant and linked data asset, yet all the clinical data continues to live in a federated fashion. And with that, my last slide here speaks to the idea that really there's a lot of discussion in the industry and about the potential value of this, but some skepticism and regarding the viability and the practicality of achieving blindfolded record linkage. And South Carolina and our, you know, 10-plus years of historical data, plus the fact that it's being used by caregivers to drive clinical care, where the tolerance level for inappropriate linkage is exceptionally low, certainly gives us a lot of hope and confidence that this may have an applicability to the kinds of efforts that that Sentinel contemplates. Thank you.
Vic, thank you very much, and would like to remind the participants on the call that they can submit questions online. We'll also open up this discussion in a few minutes. Just to start out that discussion, though, I'd like to ask Vic, David, Sue, I guess all of you might contribute to this one. You've used the term federated data network in describing the work that you do. Many of our previous discussions have focused on distributed data models, and certainly that's a core feature of a lot of the Sentinel planning. I wonder if you might talk about the difference between the two, and one particular issue is that within the SCI-X model, there is a, at least one kind of integrated data piece, and that's the administrative data for Medicaid beneficiaries, the UB 92 discharge data and some other data elements that actually are held centrally. And I wonder if you all could comment on the need for all payer claims or other integrated databases in order to make this model work more effectively, or is there not much of an impact?
This is Vic. Great question. Look, I think we use the term distributed and federated, frankly, interchangeably. I think maybe it's technically maybe the industry tends to refer to non-centralized architectures as federated architectures, but I think our thinking is that that is what we mean when we say federated, is that it's distributed. To your second question, is there some prerequisite for certain parts of the data assets to be more centralized and more aggregated? I guess, David, I'll leave that to you, but at least our experience is that it's nothing more than, as we call it, jump-starting the value proposition. In that context, it's no different than many of the large aggregated claims-based assets, whether they're from commercial folks or the HMO Research Network. They allow you to get your hands around what we would call very broad populations, but shallow data assets. There's not much depth to it. You can't get to lab results. You can't get to chief complaint. You can't get to maybe final disposition of the patient. So we call it broad but shallow. It can help with certain kinds of research questions, and the narrow and deep federated or distributed data assets in our parlance in South Carolina tend to be the harder to come by in you know, chunks of 10 million at a piece. They tend to come, you know, 500,000 to a million at a time, because that's what an integrated delivery network or a provider tends to take care of, a half a million patients or 400,000 patients. And so I think that's all, I don't think it enhances or reduces the technique's value any.
Right. That's,
although you did, you did talk a little bit.
Just chime in. That's it. I think from our perspective, the claims repository already existed, and we viewed it as a way to provide value to the provider community to help in incentivize them in some way to provide the deeper clinical data. So it was a means to an end. But I don't see anything with the architecture that makes it a requirement necessarily. It just makes things easier.
But just to be clear, when you talked about jump-starting using some of the existing data or the fact that you had multiple participants in, I can certainly see the value of having, you know, a lot of data available for building off in the exchange. I mean, that's what's going to contribute real value to the participants, of being able to have lots of other information to draw on. But from your standpoint, in your federated model, it doesn't fundamentally matter whether that's data from a central repository, like for the claims, versus data from a distributed system, like you were able to link with the hash methods.
That's correct. I mean, to us, they both look like federated servers. They're both distributed servers. It's just that one's a lot bigger than the other.
And from the provider's from the perspective of a provider organization, I can tell you, in rolling this out to providers, having jump-started it with that thin layer of longitudinal claims data made it easier to teach providers how to use it, and basically have them recognize the value. But again, I agree, it's not a necessity when you're building the deeper deeper clinical data.
At the end of the day, they're all data assets.
Right.
Okay. I'd like to open this up now to some of the questions from our other participants. And just a reminder, when I call on you, if you could unmute your line by pressing *7 if necessary, just to make sure we can hear you. And I'd like to turn to Terry Madison.
Hi, Mark. Thanks. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, good. Then I pushed the right buttons. So I typed my question in here, but I guess maybe I'm a little confused, because I think at least the way I understood what Vic was describing is that even if a third-party service is doing the blindfolded record linking, they at least need the PHI from each of the data sources that need to be linked to create the hash marks. But did I misunderstand that?
No, well, there are two models. One could hand off at a service level from each federated distributed partner at a record-by-record basis a handshake of non-hashed things across the VPN firewall to this outside party, and the very first thing that is done is that it is hashed and then persisted. And in that context, in a very legal manner, for a moment, that particular record did go over the wire. Now, from a transport layer perspective, it's still going over 128-bit encryption. So that is why we have the alternative of actually doing the hashing prior to sending, so that it's actually hashed prior to being forwarded.
And how is that latter part done?
So a small service layer widget, basically it ends up essentially implementing a double hash, because what we need to, you know, that sounds totally redundant, and in some ways it is to meet the very stringent expectation by partners that it does not leave my firewall without it being first hashed, and yet at the same time, the recipient from a key management perspective, we do not wish to have the record locator service reliant on a key that has been distributed across the board. So you leave the sanctity or the VPN of a particular federated partner using one level hash, and then the BRI actually implements a second hash.
Yeah, and so I think it's that latter that would likely have to be used in Sentinel in a lot of situations. I've got a lot of experience trying to link data, and the problem always is, and sometimes it goes down to the very agreements that a data holder has with its various providers in their network. There's a really strong reluctance, and sometimes there's a legal basis behind that reluctance, to release the data to anyone to do that linking. And so if there was a way to do that sort of before releasing it, while it's still underneath someone's firewall, I think that would work a lot better from the Sentinel perspective.
But, as you get into obviously you're aware of the implications are, part of the reason we would say it's a trade-off analysis, having keys more widely available overall increases the threat model of the system as a whole, and yet meets the legal challenge very nicely. And so you end up with what may sound like very gratuitous solutions like double hashing, which by itself doesn't do anything, but it allows us to say yes to the sending participant. Data is not leaving your control in a manner that is reversible, so it meets their needs. And yet at the same time, we, by doing a second hash, there's nothing lossy about that once the permutations have been created. It's computationally intensive. You're taking the hit on both sides. Basically, you receive that and you rehash the received pattern, and now you've got good key management as well.
Yeah. Would there be a way to, and I guess this is sort of a rhetorical question, but create a software package that's actually sold to various data holders who are participants so that they could just load that up and sort of create the hash key themselves and then provide what they're comfortable providing into the Sentinel?
And Vic, I have to ask you to keep the answer to this short. I want to get on to at least one or two more questions. An interesting discussion.
The answer is absolutely yes, and that's certainly how we provide that as a solution. Offline, I think we ought to discuss then that key, if they're actually selecting the key, would have to have some awareness on the other side as to what that key might have been.
Okay, yeah, great. Thank you.
Very interesting discussion. Let me turn to Judy Kramer. Judy, if you're still on, *7 to unmute your line.
Hi. Can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead.
Great. I was interested, you mentioned, there was a mention early on in the presentation that this is able to accommodate various different electronic health record systems, and I just wondered how much of a problem it has been for the exchange in using standard terminology and aggregating data with these various different systems that presumably didn't have a core set of standards to be put into place.
I guess I'll start and Sue can follow and then Vic can follow. It's been an issue for us, I think, as time goes on and the ONC standards become more and more defined, and they become, again, speaking from the perspective solely of an HIE, as the ONC standards become more defined and they become more closely tied to the meaningful use incentive payments, we find the responses to those standards to be picking up. So we're optimistic that over time it will get better. But we have had to do some significant workarounds on some older systems.
One of which was the older system at Carolina Health Center, which is my organization, and are still, I believe, at the point where we are not as live as everyone else. We do have to do a data dump into an adapter We're in the middle of going through a conversion to an upgraded system for that reason. Our system, quite frankly, will not meet the standards for meaningful use. So it took a good bit of work even to get to that point.
I just wondered if you had to leave out any of the community health centers, for instance. I'm particularly interested in that.
No.
And actually,
one of the nice things is the system that we're using, the older system that we're using, we've already done the legwork to know what the workaround is. So the health centers that in fact are using that system,
we can then apply it.
We can apply the workaround that we struggled through.
So the last mile problem, of we call them adapters, you know, that's completely distinct from the record locator service issue. Certainly is a core part of what, you know, our organization obsesses about. But what we have, you know, a mantra, you know, no data left behind, and certainly we go after these legacy solutions, because a large majority of the valuable data assets live in older systems that are not industry compliant with CCDs and so on. So we have a very large investment in, you know, out-of-box pre-built drivers to these environments.
So what you would say, Vic, is we actually have to, with our system, we basically have to drive the data to the adapter. Then the adapter does the work for us.
And translation and terminology management and such,
right.
Exactly.
All right. Just as people know, we've gone a couple minutes over. We do have a few more questions. I'm going to try to get one or two more in. There's a question from S. Quirishi about a related topic of standards for adverse event reporting. If you're still on, do you want to ask the question? Remember star 7? Just to ask it for them, the question was about, is there a standard terminology to capture adverse events? And I think you've touched on this issue already in response to Judy's question.
I don't believe most EHRs maintain adverse events per se. So, you know, but now that we're expanding, I think in this context, Mark, I suspect this has to do with very specific reportable events to the FDA. We would typically not find that in the EHR per se, but precursors to those events or things that don't even rise to that, that's, I think, the real opportunity that we have from our EHR linkages.
Although I will say that at the EHR level, from a risk management standpoint, there is the capability of querying for adverse events. So if this, then that, and querying to see if there's a relationship between things.
Good, thank you. And just a last question to finish up on the computational side. So hashing and possibly double hashing seems like it significantly increases the data throughput and, as you were talking about earlier, potentially the computational burden. Does that get to a level of practical significance with current computational and communications technology?
You know, Moore's Law has really been helping out here for the last little bit. I don't think it's the computational issue itself. You know, our use case scenario is the ability to do real-time linking where a patient is showing up in the ER and is a new registration at a hospital, and in real-time, within a minute or two, being able to link them to potentially 240 disparate hearts that may have data for them. At that level, it is challenging. For the kinds of needs Sentinel contemplates, I would say it's a non-event. And from a hardware footprint, I don't know, David, you all are managing the infrastructure. It's a meaty box, but I don't know if we've spent more than $100,000 total.
No, we haven't. And you know, when you started your response, Vic, the very first thing that I sort of mouthed to Sue is Moore's Law, because that really does come into play. The production box, as I just told Sue, is going to be 24 core and either 128 or 256 gig. We haven't quite settled on that of RAM. So again, it's simply because of the cost of hardware has come down via the processing power that we're very comfortable, because we're running the environment that we're using now on something substantially smaller than that. So we feel very, very comfortable.
Great. Well, thank you for the discussion and the presentations. And I want to thank you both for the very interesting summary and review of the work that you're doing, but also for the effort to apply it more directly to the issues involved in Sentinel. It's very helpful for this group, and I know we all appreciate the time and effort. So thanks again to Sue Veer, David Patterson, and Vic Kaderpal for the presentation today. Our next roundtable is scheduled for late April. Look for an email announcement coming from us about the topic and the additional details soon. Thank you all very much, and enjoy the rest of your day.